Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome everyone, wherever you are around the world. This edition of the Race MotoGP podcast sees us chat to a face that you've seen but have maybe never heard from. He's always busy in the MotoGP paddock doing deals behind the scenes and getting things and teams established, up and running and then winning. Johan Stigefelts is best known for his work with the Petronas Yamaha team over previous years, but his background was actually as a racer, coming through to 50cc and then having a year in the 500cc class back in 2001. Johan joins me, Toby Moody and Simon Patterson for a chat about team managing and the different roles he's had over the years. Welcome, Johan. Where are you in the world right now?
Yeah, thank you. Right now I'm at home in Sweden, so that's my base, basically, yeah.
Okay, well, do you still have that Spanish base during the main part of the summer?
No, I mean, me and my wife, Carolina, we moved back from Spain already in, I think it was 2006. We moved back to Sweden, and then we've been based from here since then, yeah.
So kind of the end of your racing days. Now, you've had teams in every class. You've got quite a roster, haven't you? World Supersport, World Superbike, Moto3, Moto2, and MotoGP. You're a sucker for punishment, aren't you?
Yeah. It's been a very interesting last 15 years, let's say, since we started our own team, me and my wife, in Supersport back in 2005. You know, working with so many talented riders, future world champions, and I learned so much by just running this kind of operations and meeting so many nice people and interesting people. So it's not been easy. It's been definitely very difficult and hard at times, but also a lot of satisfaction and nice moments.
What was the moment where you said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to run a team. What was that moment like, and what triggered it?
Well, if we rewind a little bit to 2004, I did the 250 World Championship with Dieter Stappert, and that year was not very good, to be honest. You know, I'm like coming to an end of 250, getting a bit fed up with the factory bike, you know, versus the privateer bikes and the tires. Everything was so big difference at that time. While my, let's say, Fonsignetto, Roberto Rolfo, and all of these guys who I've been competing with and beating many years had opportunities to get factory bikes, I was just standing still, let's say. I was doing my mediocre seasons and, you know, a top 10 once in a while, and I didn't get further. So I said to Carolina, I said, let's start a team. Let's control the team ourselves and the bikes and the equipment we have and see what we can do. And that's how the team idea started, basically, that we could do it better than the teams I was running with.
You've kind of touched on it a little bit there, Stiggy, but I think we're super used these days to Moto2, where basically everyone's on the same Calyx, everyone has the same engine, everyone has the same tires, and things are fairly equal. And you can see it in the lap times whenever you see like a second covering 25 riders. But I think people have kind of forgotten how different things were in the 250 days and how much of a difference there was between the different specs of bikes and the grid, and, you know, what a challenge it was to be at the back.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big challenge. I mean, coming from the European Championship in 97, I did really well. You know, I was up there. I was, you know, top three. I had a lot of podiums, and those times was like I said, Fonsi and Golfo, Bulega, you know, many Jay Vincent, many good riders, you know, from that all of us, you know, progress to the World Championship. And at that time, we have to remember, was like, you know, you had a committee who decided who the riders could come. You had to have a track record of, you know, results. So coming into the 250s was like a dream, of course, in the World Championship. But then it was very hard. And like you said, Simon, if you see now that the Moto2, how equal it is, and everything is like, you know, same spec of bikes, tires, etc., suspension. It's up to the team and riders to perform. For me, that's a huge progress, and nice to see how all the riders can be more competitive together.
As I said at the top, a lot of people know you as the team manager. We've seen you in the Amazon Prime documentary. We'll get around to that in a minute. But what was it like when you got your 500 ride? Here we are now, 20-something years ago. What was it like? I'm on a 500cc grid. This is pretty cool, isn't it? Do you remember those days quite fondly?
Wow. Yeah, that was...
Yes or no?
Yes and no. Yeah, I mean... Of course, looking back, it's a huge privilege to be in. If you look at the grid at that time, if you look at a photo, I saw a photo recently, you know, with me and everybody basically from the history, like everyone knows everyone on that, you know, on that grid. And then that was the good part, you know, that, wow, I can do 500s. I knew it would be a challenge. I knew it would be difficult. I knew I would be like, if I take a point, a score point, it would be like a win, you know? But it was a huge challenge because the bike wasn't really competitive. The team was very, you know, I won't say they were not well funded. They had a good, you know, funding, but they had their ideas about how to run a team and how to, you know, to make it their project with this kind of rock Yamaha with, you know, with parts collected from Team Roberts, you know, put together like a, it was a beast. It was not easy to ride and was like very hard at times. But, you know, looking back, it was not, it's an experience, you know, and something that, you know, will always have with me, of course.
So you say that you looked at the picture the other day. So on that grid was Valentino Rossi, Loris Caparossi, and look at you now. You've overseen Valentino in Petronas Yamaha. You're now working with him. You could have bet somebody 10 million euros 21 years ago, and no one would have believed what would have happened in 2022. Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it just incredible?
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, I have to pinch myself because, you know, when I first met Valentino was 1995. We were in Mugello, was a European championship. Me and my brother, we went down in our bus, you know, from Sweden to Mugello, our first European championship. We parked next to Valentino, and you know, the funny thing is, he still remember this. You know, when I talked to him about it last year, it was like, yeah, I remember Stiggy. You know, and because he was with Mauro Nocciulli. Mauro was my crew chief in 250 in 2003, and so we discussed about Mauro and this and that, and you know, that's the good thing with Valentino. He never forgets. You know, he's always so up to date with everything and the history and what's happened. And. And then, yeah, working with him last year and being his boss basically was unbelievable. Yeah.
How much easier is it, do you think, being a team boss whenever you've been a racer? Do you think it gives you an extra insight into the guys and it makes it a little bit easier to work with them?
I think, you know, every rider is big egos. You know, they all, and including myself when I was a rider. You know, you just look at your own best interest, and you know, you see. You know, I'm doing right, the team is doing wrong, this and that. You know, I was in this position many times when I was in 250 and, you know, I was upset with the team. I didn't get the right, you know, equipment, and, you know, I wanted better cylinder or pistons or whatever, you know, what you had that time. And then I think that's really good because I learned a lot being this egoistic rider, looking at myself and my best interest and not looking at the team, how much they work and struggle and, you know, just to survive and to get money and, you know, to go around, because in the end of the day, all of them down in these classes is passionate people. They do it for passion, not to get rich. You know, I mean, this is like, you know, you go through all these years to just get better results and year by year go on. It's like, you know, it's a wheel of never ending stories. I learned a lot of things being a rider, coming in as a team boss, understanding the riders more, and I could talk to them on another level, I think.
But you still got to get together a band of, even in a Moto3 team, you know, 15, 20, 25 people. You got to get the truck. You got to get the tools. You got to pay the insurance. The truck has got a huge diesel tank and it needs to go around Europe. And you've got to deal with the politics. That's how do you sleep at night of a Grand Prix weekend?
Yeah, I always said, you know, the racing is like 10% of everything behind the scenes, you know. Yeah, the racing is just the ice on the cake, and then if you happen to have a podium, it's just like wow, you know, it's like a few minutes of glory, and then back to the box, back to the trailer, back to the reality, you know, looking at bills, planning the next trip, talking to sponsor who didn't pay or whatever, you know, it's like always something going on, always problem solving. All the time, no matter which level of team. Like you said, I've been running teams from World Supersport with very low budget to MotoGP, and not only MotoGP. At that time, we had, you know, MotoGP, Moto2, Moto3, six riders, 60 staff. I think one of the biggest teams in history in MotoGP paddock, you know. So, of course, this been like just a huge challenge. Home, you work so much, you know, 24/7 at home, 7 days a week. You go to the race, you sleep, you know, different hotels, flights here and there. I think you're in a kind of vacuum. You don't understand what's going on, and you just go on and go on and go on, and you just think that this is the only thing in the world, you know, that exists.
But you signed Petronas, so you know there are the good, there are the upsides, there are the good sides, and you can't run three classes of Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP teams, you know, on a shoestring. How did the Petronas thing come about? What's the story behind that?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, we signed Petronas and it was like unbelievable, a dream come through there, because, you know, that's a sponsor that I think everybody in the industry, you know, four wheels or two wheels would like to have. So obviously with our connection with Malaysia, because it was Sepang International Circuit who was owning the team, we did Moto3 at that time. This is 2017. And we started to talk to Petronas end of 17. At that time, we like I said, we did only Moto3, but we would graduate to Moto2 with one rider, which would be Hafiz Sherin. And then, you know, we talked to them and this was the plan, but the long-term plan, I remember I was in Malaysia at the workshop, you know, with Petronas, and we made it like a timeline, you know, we were 18 Moto2 Moto3, 19 Moto2 Moto3, two riders each class, 20, you know, world champion there. And then 2021, we were aiming for MotoGP. That was our target when we did a partnership with them. So we're like, obviously, you know, we signed that deal. Hafiz was supposed to be the rider, and that didn't happen because he got the Tech 3 ride because of Folger, I believe, that pulled out. Yeah. So that was a bit interrupted, you know. We had to take different riders that year in Moto2, and it wasn't great. And then, you know, I think already in Jerez 2018 it was, we had an opportunity to go into MotoGP because Mark VDS and Aspar were like, you know, in discussion to stop. And Dorna came to us and they said, hey, we have an opportunity here. You have Petronas, you know, we can grant you the starts can you put together a team? so that it started like already in 2018 in the beginning of the year. And obviously then it was like, a lot of meetings with Petronas because they were questioning me, are you have the skills to put together the team? Do you have, you know, the knowledge to take the right riders? For sure, for me, yes, no problem at all. But, you know, to convince these people who didn't know MotoGP, the new Formula One, but they didn't know MotoGP as we do, that was very difficult, yeah.
Your connection with Malaysia, you kind of touched upon it there. It didn't start with Petronas, though, did it? It started a long time before that, and kind of everything that came building up to that point with the MotoGP team, it all started 2014, I think?
Yeah, it started mid of 2013. I didn't have anything. I was planning to set up a Moto2 team, but it didn't happen. And then I met Mia Charisman. Mia was working for Caterham F1. And he's like, yeah, come over to UK to Leafield, you know, the base of the Formula One team. So I went over there and we had a discussion, and Tony Fernandez, owning the team, also owning Air Asia, he was super interested in the two wheels. So we made a project of, because they owned Caterham cars, so they wanted to do Caterham bikes. So we did two projects. Caterham bikes came along, you know, on the side to create, you know, a business case and building bikes. While I was setting up the Moto2 team, and we started in 2014, like you said, with Sarko and Josh Herring.
Yeah, and Air Asia, they spread some money about. They sponsored some Grand Prix as well. So there was some forward push there from Fernandez, I seem to remember. So you've worked with so many riders. We've mentioned Valentino, John Hopkins. I can't remember how that came about. Just remind me.
Yeah, John Hopkins was in 2009 when we had the Superbike team. So 2009, we were running two super sport riders and two super bike riders. So it was Anthony West. He came from MotoGP Kawasaki to my team in World Supersport with an Italian rider, Vizziello. And then in Superbike, we started, and there was Haslam, Leon Haslam, and Roberto Rolfo to start off with. And Rolfo didn't perform, and we were like, you know, we had some pressure, and you know how it is. You know, it was not great, but we swapped him. And then at that time, Hopkins was available. I know his manager at that time, Bob Moore, and we started to talk, and he wanted to come back racing again. And yeah, that's how he came into World Superbike, which was not very good. I tell you, that was a disaster year for him and for the team on that side of the garage. Yeah.
Brad Binder, Darren Binder, Fabio Quartararo, of course, we'll come back to him later. Franco Morbidelli, Dovizioso, Cal Crutchlow, Jake Dixon, and Paul Lewis Salom. We have fond memories of him. He was part of the KTM family when I was involved. Always laughing, always having a bit of a giggle. I've got a photograph that I'll never share with anybody. It was just he and I messing about at Eikma one year. So difficult times as well. It's not always champagne and podiums, is it? But difficult times and unimaginable mental stress for a team and for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, one like you said, I mean, one year I remember, and I will always remember, one of the strongest year was 2012 with Luis and with Brad Binder. Brad coming in as a rookie, you know, in Moto3, first year of Moto3, and Luis is like, you know, I have, you know, it's hard to describe this character, but if of all the riders I work with, he's the biggest character of all of them, 100%, you know. Such a Latino guy with a lot of temper, but you know, we made plans before the race and he always fulfilled the plans. You know, we had such a strong relationship, me and him. And even with Brad, you know, because you know, for that year I was the team manager there, and basically Brad and Luis had their mothers with them because both of them were so young. So I had to drive around, you know, the riders and the mothers around the world. So, you know, we spending a lot of time in airplanes and cars and hotels, you know, you get to know them really well. And, you know, we had such a great time and he performed so well. The team had so little budget and we were finishing second in the world championship. And, you know, that gave him the ride in KTM IO and, you know, fighting for the championship. And unfortunately, yeah, I mean, this is one of the hardest things to talk about is Luis and what happened to him.
Maybe a little bit happier. We can have a conversation about young riders and kids that have come up through your ranks without me asking, because I know how much he means to you. How good has it been to see Ayumu Sasaki doing what he's doing this year?
Yeah, Ayumu is another. It reminding me of Luis, actually, of the character wise, because you know, yeah. His Japanese, he's such out of, you know, I mean, he's just so European minded compared to a Japanese mind. Ayumu, you know, we always knew he had talent, and he was just—I don't think he was just not ready when we started with him. And then we grow up, you know, we grow together, and then in 2019 he did better, and I mean, I have a very close relationship with Ayumu, and it's so nice to see him, you know, in the right spot now with a good bike and the right people around him. And he deserves it. I mean, he will, I'm sure he can fight for the championship next year. And you know, that brings me a lot of satisfaction when you see riders you work with from young and now they're performing.
So here we are, we're at, oh, let's just go back, should I say. We'll go back to the beginning of the 2020 MotoGP season, COVID, pandemic, lockdowns, Dorna scrabbling to get races. We got going and you end up winning Grand Prix. And there you are knocking on the door. And it's like, how, just explain the feeling and what it was like to have Fabio Quartararo there and Franco Morbidelli, you know, knocking on the door of world championships.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's hard to describe. Even me now looking back, I'm like, was I really there? You know, you look back and you think, wow, that was a year to, you know, for all of us, of course, with the pandemic, we had, you know, we struggled and we were, you know, sitting here at home and thinking, what can we do? And then once we got racing in Jerez, I remember when we went down there, we had a doubleheader in Jerez and Fabio won the first one and Frankie had some engine issues, you know, but you know, straight from the go, we were sure Fabio could win the title that year. We didn't think that Frankie could do it, to be honest, because Fabio came out of a strong 2019 season and Frankie didn't really perform that year as we were hoping for. So we were, of course, we knew Frankie had something, but we expected Fabio to you know, fight for the title, which he did up until, like, you know, Misano, I think that year. He was, you know, he won three races and he was there all the time. So, you know, to have two riders in a satellite team beating the factory official team all the time and other factories, and, you know, we were like pole positions and wins and podiums, you know, it just became a normal weekend, you know. It's maybe hard to say, but it just, you know, we were like always looking for better and more and, you know, winning, but we should win with more, you know. It's like strange how you move in this kind of, you know, areas. Once you fight for points and once you fight, then you fight for podiums and then you fight for wins. It's just the same kind of mindset. It's just, you know, the ranking is different. So
obviously, towards the end of that season, things then kind of disintegrated around Fabio a little bit. It all came crashing down all at once. What, you know, from your opinion, from your insight inside the box, what happened?
I think the, you know, Fabio from the beginning, we as you know, we have a very good, strong team around him with Diego and Pablo and the guys, you know, mechanics and they were always very calm, keeping him down. And, you know, they never really changed anything on the bike. They were like always keeping the same bike from beginning, the first test until, you know, that time when it started to fall apart. It was like, you know, this is your base. This is what you ride with. And then they started to move around a bit too much, I think, changing too many things on the bike. And, you know, he got confused and, you know, this tire pressure thing, you know, was just haunting him and he couldn't relax, you know, and as we saw, like what we saw on TV was the same in the pit box. He couldn't really relax and ride smoothly and free as when he performed. That's what he do best, you know, when he relax. But so that was the basic reason was they were, once they started to fall down a bit, they started to change a bit too much and he got nervous and Frankie was performing. And I'm not sure if that was like affecting him. I don't think so, but it didn't help, let's say.
So you are Petronas Yamaha in this 2020 season. You're winning all these Grand Prix. People think you're then a factory team. What is the relationship then like with the factory team? What's it like with the Yamaha people in blue when you're beating them?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, very respectful from both sides. You know, we had a great relationship with Yamaha. At least I did. I had a super relationship with them. You know, with Lin, I can't thank him enough because, you know, we had so many meetings from already 2018. You know, when we started the project. You know, we met him every weekend, and, you know, then going through everything, making plans. He was involved with everything. And then also the Japanese, Sumi and Hank and all of them, they were like, they were so supportive, parts guys. Everybody was like, of course, happy for us. But I could see also, of course, it was affecting them a bit that we didn't, that they didn't beat us, like, let's say. I think our team was so young and fresh and dynamic and strong and competitive. And they were like losing a little bit. They were going downhill because Maverick and Vale at that time, they were not doing their best. You know, Maverick had some ups and downs and they started to already then, I think, friction a bit inside. And we were this young team coming up with all this expectation. But then just beating them.
But you didn't know the difference. You just did it.
We just did it, exactly. We were also keeping our feet on the ground, which I said always to everybody, keep the feet on the ground. Never walk around like we are, you know, because it can change very fast. You know, it's like quickly we go from here to here. So that was the respect from our team, I think, and that was also what Yamaha saw, that we had, you know, we were experienced people inside the team who had been in the top and the bottom. You know, most of us. So that's you know, you get more humble of that for sure.
When Tech 3 split with Yamaha, and you guys became the Yamaha satellite team, and then again, whenever the team that took over from what was your team split with Yamaha to go to Aprilia, we heard the same thing about Yamaha treat their satellite teams a little bit differently. They treat them more like customers than partners. But it seems like that wasn't the case, at least for a few years while you were there, that the relationship was stronger than that.
I mean, yes and no. Sometimes, you know, and I can understand from their side that we are a customer, yes. But we're also a partner. But you know, I will say sometimes you felt like just a customer, paying customer. But I would say most of the time I felt the partnership because, like I said, at least from my side, the experience I gained from I'm bringing up Lin again, especially from him, because he was very he took care, you know, he took care even though for him he's a business, you know, but he took care of us. He was looking after us. He was interested in many things. He wanted to be involved in a lot of stuff going on. So, you know, that's how I see it.
I think he could just see quite simply the bigger picture. Maybe he knew that he was in trouble with Vinales and, dare I say it, Valentino. And he could see the bigger picture of you guys with the coolest looking bike, by the way. That was just the coolest color scheme and livery that was of recent years, I have to say. But he could see the bigger picture that on balance going to a Grand Prix, you were going to be the top Yamahas.
Yeah, I mean, we were like, yeah, everybody saw that. Like you said, with the whole team was factory, you know, when we showed up, you know, with the whole team, with everything from hospitality to trailers to, you know, the whole look of that team was just looking factory. And that was one of my work, of course, to make it that, because it was the demand from Petronas to have a, you know, it has to be F1 level. So, you know, that was one of the biggest challenges from 2018 to create all of this. Was so tough to bring, first of all the people in with all this experience, and then creating the infrastructure, you know, behind and just having everything ready and looking, you know, $1 million and everything. This was one of the biggest challenges of my life, basically.
I have to say, I disagree slightly on the livery, and not because I didn't like the 2019-2021, but because I think the 2018 Moto3, where it was a lot more black, is just the coolest thing ever. That was my favorite of all of your co-color schemes. Towards the end of that year, towards the end of 2020, we started to get a picture of there being something wrong at Yamaha in terms of the engines. We, as it all turned out in the end, there was some manufacturing problems with the valves, and it cost you guys more than anything else. Did it cost Frankie a title?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. Yeah, this is my or our opinion inside the team that it, you know, you can always look back and say if this and if that. Of course, you know this, then everybody would be world champions. But you know, this was it was out of our hands. We couldn't do anything. And to be honest, a little bit out of Yamaha's hands as well. They put together parts that they believed was right, and it wasn't. So, you know, at that time we were like really upset and pointing fingers. And then, but again, they came to us very open, very honest, and we discussed, and it was very clear. So, you know, we had to stand behind Yamaha, of course.
What was it like working with Wilco Zeilenberg, another ex-racer?
Yeah, Wilco was like one of the guys. If I go back again to 2018, when we you know, created the team, which was my role to get the people together, Wilco was one of the guys I, you know, wanted in the team because, you know, he had experience with Yamaha. He knew a bit of course, MotoGP because he'd been the performance analyst of Lorenzo and working with Yamaha for a long time. And I know him. I knew him from the Supersport times when I had my team in World Supersport. Wilco was running the Yamaha team there. So, you know, Wilco was a good guy for let's say, people's manager. Let's say his role was put there to manage the MotoGP structure and to make sure we you know follow up in meetings with Michelin, with Yamaha, with his experience, you know, make sure everything was running in the team there. So it was an experience. Yeah, it was good to have, and it was important to have him in the structure. That was my philosophy there at that time.
Obviously, there were still three teams running at that point. And I think Wilco, the MotoGP team is very much Wilco's baby, but you were also still trying to juggle the other two teams as well with Moto2 and Moto3. It's a lot on the plate at once.
Yeah, I mean, for me, looking at, you know, if you ask everybody inside the team, it was like, of course, Raslan being the boss, me running the operations, meaning operations, Moto2, Moto3, MotoGP, making sure we had everything. Wilco was my guy to make sure the MotoGP team, like I said, was running. But Wilco was an on-track manager, basically. He didn't work a lot of between the races. It was my job, Gaslan and other guys. We were making sure that we had everything we needed for running the team. So Wilco's job was, yeah, performing at the races, but between the races, he was involved in things, but he was not operating as we did.
And I know that the Moto3 team kind of ran the same way to an extent with Mark Woodage and the team that you'd put together from the very beginning there. So it must have got to the point where going to races was actually your chance for a bit of time off.
Yeah, time off, but, you know, a lot of, you know, like I said, I was so busy from, you know, Friday morning, you know, Moto3, FP1 until, you know, Moto2, MotoGP. And then you were like, because I wanted to be everywhere, of course, looking after everything was okay. And, you know, there was interviews, there was these things. But then, of course, also I had six managers to take care of, you know, six rider managers who was always on my case.
That they're worse than the riders, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, then you have the riders, the managers, and you know, some sponsors, then performing, problem solving again. But like you said, Simon, yeah, for sure going to the races was not as much work. Let's say at home, it's more in the office, more like administrative stuff, you know, paying bills and make sure we are running budget and things like that.
What was it like working with Raslan Razli? How did that all shake out?
Well, you know, when we started in 2015, Raslan was the CEO of the circuit, and we folded the AirAsia team because Tony stopped with the Formula One and everything. So then I met Raslan in 2014, in June, I think, July, and he told me he had a plan to set up a Moto3 team, and he wanted me to be involved. And at that time, I said no, because, you know, I was running the Moto2 team for Eric, and that we didn't plan to stop it. But then everything happened what happened, and then, yeah, we got in touch again, and, you know, we made these plans, and he was fighting very hard for making this Moto3 team in Malaysia to make sure we could run it, because it was not that easy. The board of directors of Sepang Circuit didn't want to do it. They questioned why should we have a team, etc. You know, and for us it was like, you know, we need to bring in Malaysian talent and try to develop the Malaysian riders. So he was fighting very hard for that, which was great. And then those years, I was running the team. He was make sure that we had budget and everything was going well, but he didn't go to so many races. He was maybe 4 or 5 times a year at the races. And then obviously when we started the MotoGP team, it became more work for him. But he was also the CEO in 2019 and the team principal. So we were like, you know, we're working very close together, and we had a great relationship, in my opinion, all these years. We were had mutual respect for each other. I was doing my things, he was doing his things, and we, of course, always connected, you know, with riders, with budget, with, you know, planning for future, etc. So it was good years until the last year, basically, was all good for me.
So just for those who are listening and maybe don't know this, I actually spent 6 months about this time working with Stiggy and Raslan as part of the team as well. I was Stiggy's press officer at the end of 2019. So I've got a little bit of insight into what was, you know, into these times with you. I think we've talked a little bit about expectations and, you know, targets in this podcast, but I think it's fair to say that Raslan is someone that always has high expectations. I think his Thursday night team prep talks and hospitality are a thing of legend in the paddock at this point because of some of his ambitions. Did that make things difficult to work with, or is that just another part of your job, was something to manage and something to control?
I mean, at times it was quite hard because, you know, I won't say that he don't understand racing, but you know, he does, of course. He's been in the Sepang circuit, but he's not born with racing as I am, and many other team managers and team principals and, you know, people working in the paddock. They were born into it, basically. They were riders, they were, you know, competing in on the highest level. And then to explain certain things to him that it doesn't really work like that, that was a challenge at times. And that was good to have Wilco on my side many times. We were like, me and Wilco, like many times telling him, no, this, it doesn't work. You know, he wanted to get his way through in certain things. And we said, no, it doesn't work. You know, but when it was me and Raslan alone, it was sometimes difficult to explain things it doesn't work like that. But sometimes it also, you have to remember, is also sometimes good to have somebody from the outside who don't understand to get a kind of fresh breath of air and different ideas. So sometimes it worked and sometimes not.
I think that's probably something that most fans have actually got a little bit of understanding of, because it's something that came across quite well in the documentary. That dynamic between the three of you was something that they focused on quite a bit. You guys had a really weird time while the cameras were in the box. Was that, you know, was it a distraction?
I mean, Raslan loved the cameras there, you know.
I could see that.
Like, he loves the camera, and I try to be not too much in the camera view and angle. And it was at times, it was difficult, of course. And then... Looking back, you know, how they angle things, you know, how you get, you know, from the audience, that's like sometimes not great. But on also some occasions he was right, you know, the cameras did the right thing.
I think that the scene we all remember in the documentary is you and Vico Zeilenberg on the left and Raslan on the right, and it just didn't look like a team. It was you versus him and him versus you, and that was the impression I got.
Yeah, this is the reality. From the last year, it was like that. You know, it was very good. And We started to fall apart a bit, and it happened, you know, already in the beginning of the year. I felt like this is going to be a hard year, you know, because, you know, we had we had Valentino, we had the last year of Valentino of his career, and we knew that. We knew what we signed up with. We knew it would be difficult. And his expectations on Valentino was always too high. You know, he was like, you know, we need better. He needs to do better. We need to perform. But, you know, we didn't. So we now take this opportunity and work with Vale, his last year of this unbelievable career, the best rider in history, and just embrace it and do the, you know, support him basically. And that was the challenge, you know, from the beginning. Obviously, on the other side of the garage, you had our struggle as well with Frankie not performing and complaining, and the bike is too old and this and that, and changing, you know, I think we had 4 or 5 riders that year. So the whole thing was so difficult from the first 2 years being unbelievable. And then we run into the shit, and then it started to fall apart, you know.
But you work with Valentino Rossi. Come on.
Exactly. You know, that's what I'm like, you know, very proud of. And we work with him, and such a great character, and always positive anyway. So
how did Valentino come into the garage? Because he'd come from a factory team. He'd been a factory rider for essentially his entire career. And suddenly he's kind of being relegated to, even though you guys had performed better than the factory team in the previous years, it would have been easy to see it as a step down, but he never really seemed to think that way. He was just Valentino, just in different colors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have to remember he brought some guys with him. We know Matteo and David, his crew chief and data guy, and we made an agreement there to UK. You can bring these guys. We need to keep some guys in the box. And he was very polite and very respectful to that. You know, he respected us a lot because he saw what we did these 2 years. And you know, he see things that, you know, this is like, it is like a factory team. You know, for him it was like coming in as a factory rider in a factory team, because you know it didn't change a lot for him. The colors changed. The bike was the same. The closest people around him was the same. So I mean, it wasn't huge different there, you know. It's just on I think I would say it would be more relaxing for him not having all the focus from the factory all the time. But I think he felt also a bit he was a bit disappointed, because of course he wanted the better results, he wanted to change the bike a bit to his liking, and it didn't happen. So you know, he was disappointed in Yamaha as well at some point in that year. But he kept his head up anyway and did his best. And yeah, he finished off well in Valencia, you know, with the best result of the year, and he did a great race. So that was good.
What was your abiding memory, maybe away from the racetrack with Valentino? Was it a restaurant? Was it a nightclub? Was it going to the ranch? What was I'll remember this for a long time moment?
I mean, we didn't go out much that year, to be honest. We didn't have a lot of off track moments. I would say this year been more off track moments with Vale, working with his team now. It's been more, you know, also him retiring, he's more relaxed. So this year been a couple of nice evenings out with him, which been very nice, because you know, then he can relax, I can relax, and we are on a different level right now, and both of us, and that's been nice actually.
I've heard rumors about what nights out with Valentino are like, and I've had a few nights out with you, Stiggy, so I can only imagine.
Hard, you know, experience there.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
So, Johan, you're now with the VR46 MotoGP team. Having worked with Valentino at Petronas Yamaha, he took you under his wing and took you with him. Is that literally how it all shook out for you, Johan Stigefeldt?
Like we most of us know, I had a hard year last year, you know, finishing like we did with the Petronas team. And, you know, because, you know, I just have to say, many of the people there and guys and girls, they were like my friends, and we had to stop something great. You know, there was, like I said, almost 60 people working there, and to leave that was very hard for me, because basically I had a relationship with everyone. I hired most of them, so they were working for me, so it was tough. And I think Vale saw that, and especially his, you know, people around him, Max and Uccio and Gianluca, you know, Gianluca Falcioni, the manager of Frankie, and also the managing director of VR46. We had built up a great relationship, me and him, and he felt like, you know, we need to work with you, Stiggy, because you have experience, you have, you know, a lot of knowledge, you have a lot of connections. And so he suggested me, first of all, inside the structure, because they already had a structure with Pablo and Uccio and them running the team. So we had to basically create a role for me in late stages. And he proposed to Vale that I should work with him and more on the business side, partnerships. And Vale, of course, approved. So he's the guy who says, yeah, we need Stiggy. Stiggy should be here. It's good for us. So in the end of the day, he approved that it would be good to have me in the structure. And then we have to remember, 9 people came from Petronas to VR46. And I suggested a lot of them people going there because they are good people with a lot of experience and in their areas.
When did you kind of realize that you needed to start looking for something? Because we saw a little bit of the timeline with Petronas pulling out, and then it looked like the team would carry on and that you'd still be involved in it. And then it didn't look like that. It all seemed quite messy.
Yeah, it was very messy. I mean, still today, I don't know really why I'm not there. I have never got an explanation for it, and that's tough. But, you know, on the other side, I need to move on for myself and my family, and you know, at one point I was thinking, you know, to stop completely with MotoGP, to stop completely with the racing, to do something else. I had some other offers, to be honest, on the table, which was very nice, very good from the private sector, let's say, which I was considering. But then I think it was around Misano time, second Misano after Austin, that I came back and I'm like, you know, I had this meeting with VR46 and with Gianluca, and I felt, okay, let's do it, you know. But I said, I need to take a breather. I can't be so much involved. I need some space. I need to, you know, I need time to bring up my passion again, because I to be honest, I really lost all my faith and passion end of last year in the sport, and that was very tough, you know, very tough, because I've been doing this all my life, basically, and that's what I know. When you work with something for so many years, you think that this is the only thing I know of, this is the only thing I can do. It's tough to just be taking that away from you when you don't control it yourself, basically. So anyway, I got this opportunity, and I was thinking, I spoke to my wife, and, you know, me and her always done these things together. And she said, yeah, okay, if you feel like, you know, you want to do it, go ahead and see what that can lead to.
And it's looked this year, from what I've seen for you personally, it looks like it's worked. It looks like you've got your passion back, and it looks like a lot of fun inside that team.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a great team, a great team atmosphere, which you know, I respect, and it's not easy always to build up that thing. And My role now, yeah, it's basically nothing compared to what I've done, but it's nice. You know, I'm enjoying myself. I can see things from a different angle, which is very good. You build more experience because, you know, for me, everything in life is about experience, and then you build up your database, let's say your own base of knowledge. And I've done so much in motorcycle racing. Like Toby said, I've done all the classes, you know, I've done so many things as a rider, and now doing these things with VF46, which is for me the biggest brand in the world, connected with motorcycle apart from manufacturers. It's a privilege to work with them, yeah.
So just to explain, what are you doing at VR46? You're not the team manager, you're not the team principal, it's something very different. What is it?
Yeah, it's something very different, but something I've done before as well. It's basically looking for sponsors, making sure we have budget and partners, and bringing in new business opportunities to VR46. So end of the day, looking for sponsors, working with Gianluca, and we are a group of people there doing this job. So we have our team in the team doing these things, and it's nice because we're doing this together, but with the team, of course, behind.
So you are an Italian team. You have got the might of Valentino Rossi above the door and running, you know, there. The name is in the team. You ring up a sponsor, you bump into a sponsor, you pitch to a sponsor, oh, it's for Valentino. Surely the doors just open. Surely they just open.
Easiest
in Italy.
Job in the paddock.
It's not that easy.
Surely you're selling ice creams on the beach in Los Angeles. Come on.
Yeah. No. I mean, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, there is, you know, many, many companies and people who want to be connected with the team because it's end of the day, it's Valentino Rossi's team. But we know he's not so connected with the team because he's doing his car racing, and, you know, he give it to Uccio to manage. But, you know, Vale is Vale. And I will say there's a lot of Italian sponsors. This team is very Italian focused, you know, from sponsor side. My job is to find sponsors outside of Italy, to find more partners connected with the world championship we're in, and that's not so easy all the time. I mean, this is like, you know, VR46 and Valentino Rossi is big in Italy and many places around the world, but not everywhere, you know. So many sponsors nowadays also want a business to business case. They want, you know, connected with the brand. So that's quite challenging sometimes, but also very nice to work with. Yeah.
Is there something that you've looked into from VR46 MotoGP team, the VR46 Academy? Is there something that you could somehow hook up with Valentino's car racing as the same brand? Have you looked into that? I mean,
The car racing side is more on Gianluca's side to manage, you know, and then that's. But obviously, if we have a partner who want to be involved with him personally and the team, we are, of course, we can discuss and we can find ways. But Valentino won't also sign up with anyone. He's also very selective in the way of working with partners, etc.
What's it like dealing with, I mean, I know you're not the team manager per se, but I'm still curious, what's it like dealing with Ducati from that MotoGP perspective with Luca and Marco as the riders? What's it like as a customer Ducati team?
Yeah, I'm not directly involved, but I hear things and I am, you know, involved behind the scenes, some part of it, you know, and for me, it looks like a great relationship. Obviously, Ducati it's heavy for them to have 8 bikes on the grid, 6 customer, you know, bikes, and that's not very easy. From my perspective, it's been quite challenging, but they did it, which is, you know, hats off to them because it's not been an easy year.
Do you think they're too thinly spread with their engineers?
I won't say that. I think they are very, you know, they are very involved in every rider, in every, you know, especially, I will say in the beginning, maybe not that much in the team, but then when the team start to perform and do better, they come and they discuss, which is normal. It's obvious, you know, like that's how it works. We all know that. The better you do, the more interest, etc. So, No, they're doing a good job. They work differently from Yamaha, definitely, because I've seen both. So there's a different kind of setup behind the scenes from Yamaha and Ducati.
There's obviously a full management structure. Yourself, Gianluca, Pablo Nieto, Ucho, Albi Tribaldi, all these people in VR46. But how much of a day-to-day role does Valentino have? Like, is he still the guy that signs off on all the big decisions? Is he still the, you know, coming to all these meetings or joining by Zoom or whatever to keep an eye on things?
No, he's very focused on his car racing now. So he's, you know, that's his main objectives. But obviously within VR46, there's a board and Valentino is the boss and you know, he... You know, everything has to go through him, basically. So he's like you say, he signs off the big things and the big decisions, not the small ones. I think, you know, this is not like, you know, but the big decisions is going through him for sure.
You said you had a bit of a mental dip, almost fell out of love with the sport last year. I know exactly what you're talking about, but is your enthusiasm back as strong as it ever has been? Did you almost need to have that break?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Maybe it was, you know, this was a good moment to step out of it in some ways to because like I said before, you're stuck in a wheel and you never get out of it. If you're there, you keep going year after year after year and you think this is the only thing in life. But it's not.
It's not, no.
In that way, it was very good that I could get a break and get out of it. Because I wouldn't like to be in the position of Gaslan this year in the team, because I know it's been tough and the struggle, and not only him. To run a MotoGP team now is not easy. You know, you need first of all budget, and you need to rely on sponsors, and you know there is the situation in the world, it doesn't help. You know, with war and you know, the inflation, everything is affecting the sport for sure. So in that way, it was a nice way to get out of it and just, you know, focus on other things in life. But the, like I said before, the way it happened it left a very bitter taste. The way it happened for me, I didn't deserve that. You know, I didn't deserve to be treated like that end of the year and to have that kind of disrespect towards me.
Okay, looking forward, what's your opinion about the Saturday afternoon sprint races, the Sprint Grand Prix? What's your point of view from a racer?
I think it's going to be good in a way of as a racer, because you know when it's race day, you mentally you are more, yeah, you're more focused some way somehow. You know, when it's a race day, you show up and it's more tension in the air from. Everyone, not only the rider. So I think from that way, it's going to be more, you know, more competitive. It's going to be nice to have a, you know, another race. But I don't think from my own way, I think we should have done like maybe 5 or 6 next year, starting off small and maybe grow it. Not every single weekend. It's going to be very hard for the riders and the teams, because it's a different mindset, like I said, from everybody on race day.
Couldn't agree more. It's been wonderful to catch up. I think it's snowing outside with you at the moment. It's certainly a wet day here in the UK, and I don't know if it's sunny in Northern Ireland.
It's beautiful here. Absolutely beautiful.
Send some Sorry. Sun over. Send some sun over. Johan, we were coming back from Suzuka one year. I don't know when it was. 90s, late 90s, early zeros. I genuinely can't remember. Think about it. And we were coming back from Suzuka and we were flying out of Osaka Airport, the man-made airport in the bay. And we were going to take off at 12:45 on a Monday morning, Monday lunchtime, and the plane didn't take off. And everybody rushed to the desk. I want to get on the next plane back to Europe. And I just said, can I have my bags, please? And everybody said, well, what are you doing? I said, because you won't get on the plane. Just let them put you up in a hotel and we'll do it again on Tuesday. And you and me and Jeremy McWilliams and a few of his Northern Ireland friends, colleagues, we all ended up in a hotel on a Monday night. And of course, you know what happened.
Yeah, I haven't heard this story and I know what happened.
like Simon said before, you know, to go out with us, it's a good time.
Yeah. it's a good time, and we all do. And of course, and it got later and later, and McWilliams is there, so of course it's just times two. Never mind a bit of Scandinavian drinking. I jest because you were still a racer, but you know what I mean. And I said something to you, and I'm sure it was then. I said, but the thing is, Stiggy, you're far too intelligent to be a motorcycle racer. And you hated me. You wanted to poke my eyes out. and actually, what you've done since you've stood away from racing and put your crash helmet on the shelf has been nothing short of quite spectacular. To do what you've done, I take my hat off to you, because the stress involved in all of that and chasing sponsors, as you say, is another level, and getting a great team together is the best feeling in the world, but to get there is no easy task, and I take my hat off to you. Fair play.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's been tough, but I hope I contributed a good part of what I've done to the sport, and you know, I have so much passion for this sport, and I won't lose it. But it's been very tough, like you said. But you know, you have to look at the good times. You don't remember the bad times so much. You only tend to look at how good it was. You know, so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You just erase the bad bits, don't you? And over time, you only remember the good bits, like the Monday night in the Osaka airport. Yeah, we had some fun. We had some fun. Good days. Jørgen Stigefelt, you're part of the VR46 team going forward in MotoGP. It's great to have you on our race podcast. Thank you for joining us. Have a great winter.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. Same to you.
Thank you, Simon, for joining us. And keep in touch with everything that we've got going on at therace.com. And remember to send in your questions to podcasts@the-race.com for Simon, Val and I to discuss. And also Tom Jojic, the crew chief who's been working in MotoGP up and down the pit lane for the last 20 years or so. We've got a series of podcasts with Tom talking about 500s, 990s, Casey Stoner, and also how Ducati have done so well in the recent years, and of course being victorious in the 2022 MotoGP season. So send in your voice messages to podcasts@the-race.com. From Johan Stigefelt, from Simon Patterson, and myself, Toby Moody, thank you for listening. Speak to you soon.
The Athletic.